His face. Okay, so this is in direct analogy how we can how we have time and we have a time translation, and the corresponding operator is a Hamiltonian. So in this case, the supersymmetry translations are this. What's this? Plus eta, theta plus epsilon, theta star plus epsilon star, where epsilon and epsilon star are infinitesimal SUSY parameters. And then we defined a superfield, which is a function on a superspace, theta, theta star. So it has a bunch of components, and if we do Taylor series expansion, it starts with a scalar, plus there is a left-handed, well, there is a Weyl fermion. Okay, minus conjugate. And then there is the highest component. Okay, so this is our superfield. So what we did last time is that, much like translations in quantum mechanics, so I can identify, so there is an operator that generates this translation, and that's a Hamiltonian. And so I can define a Hamiltonian as a differential operator that acts on a wave function. So this is I del t, okay? And so similarly, a translations on a superspace, as given there, actually give rise to two differential operators. Okay, so there is theta equals del over del theta, well, it's q plus I theta star del over del t, and then I have q dagger, which is del over del theta star, and then plus I theta del over del t. So much like in this case, we had a variation of a wave function. So it was an operator epsilon I del t acted on this wave function. So this was in the context of just quantum mechanics. So in this case, delta SUSY is that epsilon q plus epsilon star q star, delta SUSY on the superfield, it's this infinitesimal differential operator acted on superfield. So so what we showed that, and then of course we have a Hamiltonian of the system, which is realized as a differential operator as before. And then what we showed is that we do have a realization of a supersymmetry algebra. And to H, as it must be the case. And then what we finished last time is we studied the supersymmetry variations of various, so given that general rule, we can figure out what is the supersymmetry variation of each component of the superfield. So let me write it down here. So delta phi of t was equal to epsilon psi minus epsilon star psi star delta psi of t is epsilon star f minus I phi dot, and then delta psi star of t epsilon f plus I phi dot. And the most important thing was that the highest component of the superfield, that capital F, was transforming as a total derivative. So it was minus I epsilon psi dot plus epsilon star, psi side out stuff. And I believe I fixed all the confusions with stars as I had before. All right, so that's where we ended yesterday. And so this is a very important observation that we will make use of very shortly. So what I want to, if you look at this supersymmetry transformation, it's clear that it's a linear transformation, right? So if I have a product of two superfields, and if I do a SUSY variation for a product of superfields, so suppose I have phi 1, so it's a superfield, it's defined on the superspace as before, and I take a product of them, and I want to know how does the product of this of the superfield transform, precisely because this guy can be realized as a linear differential operator implies that the product of superfields will transform as a superfield. So in particular, the transformation will be delta phi 1 times phi 2 plus phi 1 delta phi 2. Okay, so this is simply follows from the fact that a supersymmetry transformation, so this is SUSY. So this simply follows from the fact that a supersymmetry variation is a first order differential operators. And so what we did here is pretty much just use the differentiation of a product of two functions. Okay, so it doesn't matter, it's very general, because notice that this supersymmetry variation is actually a bosonic operator. So it will commute with everything. Okay, so the conclusion is that if phi 1 and phi 2 are superfields, so they transform as the superfields, then the product of them, phi 1, phi 2, is also a superfield. Okay. Or we can, of course, generalize it even more. So we can say that an arbitrary polynomial of a superfield is a superfield. Okay. Actually, I'm gonna keep it. An arbitrary is a superfield. So now once we realize that, that immediately tells us how we can easily construct Lagrangians, which will be invariant under supersymmetry transformation. Okay? So immediately follows how to construct SUSY invariant actions. Right, so the idea, what we have to do is, suppose we have a L of phi, right, an arbitrary polynomial, of a superfield phi, so then it is a superfield. So the statement is that if we take, since it is a superfield, it will have its highest component, right? So if we extract the highest component of that superfield, L of phi, okay, so we call the highest component capital F, and I'll put a subscript L, meaning that it's the highest component of this Lagrangian, right? So then we are guaranteed that under the supersymmetry transformations, F sub L will transform as a total derivative right. So we just showed that arbitrary polynomial of superfields is a superfield, and we know that the highest component of any superfield transforms as a total derivative. So that tells us that if we write down our action, so SUSY supersymmetry invariant action, I can write down as a derivative of a space-time, so in our case it's just time, of the highest component of the superfield. Okay? Then it's clear that automatically that construction is invariant under SUSY variation. Why? Because if I act with this on the with the SUSY variation, right, then I will have del t, delta SUSY variation of F sub L, right? But that guy is gonna be just what we computed there. So it's dt, and then I have minus I, right? Epsilon psi dot L plus psi bar psi dot L, right? And that's a total derivative. So we have, we realized a supersymmetric action in such a way that the supersymmetry variation leads to a total derivative of a Lagrangian. Okay? And so given our rules, how we deal with quantum field theories, that we assume that for every field we have, they vanish at the boundaries, right? So in this case, they would vanish at minus infinity to plus infinity. So that tells us that this variation will be zero. So our action constructed in this way will be invariant under supersymmetry transformation. So is there a nice way how we can extract this highest component? And in fact it is, and it's a very natural way. So the highest component of the superfield, if you look up there, the part that is not erased, it's theta theta star. So how can I get this highest component? Well, I can get the highest component by looking at take the full superfield, in our case it's a polynomial, and look at the theta, theta star component. But I can be even more fancy, and what I can do, I can actually write this down. How do I extract this component? I can think of this that I'm evaluating the integral d over d theta star of my full superfield. Okay? So the reason why this is useful, because so this guy is del over del theta, and this guy is del over del theta bar, okay? And so this gives me minus the highest component of the superfield. Okay? So that tells us that I can easily construct a SUSY invariant action by taking a Lagrangian, which is a polynomial in superfields, okay? And extending the integral from the space-time integral into the integral over the whole superspace. In this particular case, it will be adding these two Grassmann integrations. Okay? So the claim is that once I do that, I automatically get actions which are invariant under supersymmetry transformation. Is that clear? Great, good. Small phi, it will be small phi, and we will do explicit computations and we will see exactly what actions we will get. The point is that the simplest one we will write down will happen to be our supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Yes, please.
Field configuration with Stadtteil, I mean, you can have domain wall or something like solution.
Yes, then you have to be very careful. So if you have a defect, what can happen is that you have
supersymmetry in the bulk, because this statement is that you have a supersymmetry in the bulk of this, and then the supersymmetry in principle can be broken by your defects. So that can often happen, and there are constructions of this type. Now, can somebody tell me why the actions that we constructed up to now are useless?
So I gave you a whole class of actions. Why are they useless? Why they are not inverse? Why we cannot do anything with them? Sorry? Right. No derivatives, no dynamics.
I just told you that so the way we've been constructing our polynomials, our Lagrangians, we were just taking a product of superfields, and so there are no derivatives, so there is no dynamic. So what we need to do, but of course, if there would be a way for me to introduce a derivative, then I would have to repeat the same words I did. And so our next step would be to enlarge a superfield, so enlarge space of superfields to superfields that include derivatives. Okay, so how we do that? Well, the most naive way would be, okay, so we have a superfield, right? A superfield is a function of t theta and theta star. So the most naive way would be, well, you know, naive, would be to just take a derivative, time derivative of a superfield, okay? So just evaluate del t of phi, right, of t theta, theta star, where by this I mean, again, I have to write it down in terms of components and differentiate any component, all of the, each component. Now, the reason why this is naive, is because this is not a superfield, okay? So this construct is not a superfield, meaning that I cannot easily extend the formalism that I just discussed. So it's not correct to just take what we had before and extend it to a superfield and the derivative, time derivative of a superfield. The reason is because this guy is not a superfield. So the whole beauty of the construction, that all I had to do to get supersymmetry invariant action is just to extend the integral over the whole superspace, just falls apart, okay? So the reason why this is not a superfield is very similar as we do in, as happens, for example, in gauge series, right? So if you take a, you can ask the same question, how do I make kinetic terms for, say, fermions that carry gauge charges invariant? What you have to do, you have to replace the normal derivative with a covariant derivative. And the reason you want to replace it with a covariant derivative, so that covariant derivative would commute with the gauge transformation. So the problem that is happening here, the reason why that is not a superfield is precisely because if I look at those two operators, so I have a supersymmetry variation and I have a differentiation with respect to time, so those two guys do not commute, okay? And we need them to commute. So if they were to commute, then we would have that guy to be a superfield. So what this tells us is that we need we need to introduce SUSY covariant derivatives, and I'm going to call them D. What's the other one I called it? Right, D and D dagger in such a way that D with delta SUSY commutator equals to zero with delta SUSY equal to zero. So if those commutators would vanish if we introduce them in such a way, then if we would succeed in this, then we can take a superfield and we can act on that superfield with a covariant derivative, and then D of phi is a superfield, because delta SUSY acted on D phi, because of the commutation there would be the same as D acted on delta SUSY of phi. Okay, so all I have to do is now to solve this problem for you, give you the explicit representation. How do we have to extend the time derivative into a covariant derivative on a superspace? So is the logic clear? Okay, so let's look at this. So let's look here. So we have D must commute with epsilon Q plus epsilon star times Q star. So this commutator must vanish. But epsilon and epsilon star are Grassmann parameters, okay? So the way how we construct D is gonna be a Grassmann derivative as well. So in order to achieve this commutator to vanish, so what we need to do is we need D to anti-commute with Qs. And the same for the Hermitian conjugate of D. So if we find out Grassmann differential operators with this property, then we are done. Okay? And I'm just gonna give you the answer. It's a fairly straightforward exercise to play around. So D, the answer is this, is D over D theta minus I theta star D over DT, and the other one, D star equals D over D theta minus I theta del over del T. And so let me remind you here that we had for Q is exactly the same as those guys, except that we had a plus sign. Okay. So what we need to do now is just to verify that two guys indeed anti-commute, and that's an easy exercise. So okay. So I'm not gonna do this. You can look and figure it out for yourself. For example, once we start anti-commuting this and this, right? So those two terms anti-commute, right? So this guy anti-commutes with this because the derivative with respect to theta, and here we have theta star, and the same, this guy will anti-commute with this, and here we have theta star, and the anti-commutator of those is zero as well. So you can actually ask, what is the algebra that's satisfied by this covariant derivatives, which will be useful. Well, much like generators of the supersymmetry transformations, D squared and D star squared are zeros, so they anti-commute with themselves. And the anti-commutator of D D star is minus twice the Hamiltonian, which again, not a surprise, because the only difference is the sign in front of del over del t differential operator, and that is related to a Hamiltonian. All right, so very good, so we achieved it. So now we know the general rule, that in order to construct, their Lagrangians that would lead to supersymmetric actions, we'll just take an arbitrary polynomial of superfield, a covariant derivative of a superfield, and its complex conjugate, right? And then we are done. So this is most general. So an arbitrary polynomial of course, we can have additional symmetries. For example, we can ask the question that we have preserved, well, once we go to four dimensions, we can preserve Lorentz transformation and so on. And that would put additional constraints. For example, additional constraint is that we might not want Lagrangians which have more than twice time derivatives, right? So we don't have higher derivative quantum field series, but as of for now, it's an arbitrary polynomial, and then automatically Susi invariant action is just this. All right. Very good. So. So any questions here? So exactly the same tricks we will use in four dimensions. Okay, so there will be an exactly the same framework which will allow us to very easily construct supersymmetric actions in four dimensions. So once we introduce superspace that includes four spacetime dimensions, and then we introduce superfields on this spacetime, then we can construct a Susi invariant action just by integrating of arbitrary polynomial of superfield and covariant derivatives of the superfield over the Grassmann part of the superspace. Right? So now the simplest example, the simplest imaginable example that we can make, and we will see that that will lead us to our supersymmetric quantum mechanics or zero plus one dimensional quantum field series that we discussed before is this one. And so this is a computation I want to do in some detail. So so what we will do now, we consider the case where our Lagrangian I'll just write it down, and so minus 1/2 d phi d dagger phi and then plus f of phi. Okay, so here phi is a real superfield. So it's real. And f of phi is an arbitrary real function. Okay? So we will see that our supersymmetric quantum mechanics is exactly that. So that's what we will try to do. We will explicitly evaluate the, some of the questions that were before, what happens with little phi and so on. So what we will do, we will explicitly do this first step evaluate the Grassmann integral, and the action that we will get will be exactly the same action as we obtained before for the 0 plus 1 dimensional supersymmetric quantum field theory. And this function f is the function that is a superpotential. So you can see that supersymmetric actions, when written in a superfield language, is much more simple. Yes.
It's a superfield. Yes. It's important that it is a superfield. Because, you know, the Lagrangian, I cannot just take a component of it. Because then I will screw up the whole ideology. Because once it is a superfield, it guarantees me that it will transform its total derivative under the supersymmetry transformation. So I really need to keep it as a superfield.
So that will lead to slight complications how we will evaluate this Grassmann integral, but it's not that bad. All right? So let's go ahead and just do this exercise. Yes?
What happens if Grassmann is, for example, an exponential?
At the level of whether my action will be supersymmetric or not, there is no requirement. What you are asking to whether there will be a ground state which is supersymmetric or not, that will restrict possible f's. Now, I already gave it up for you that f is the same f as was in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So for example, if that will happen to be an odd function of phi, then there will be no supersymmetric ground state. But it will still be a supersymmetric action.
By polynomial, I also assume the infinite
series, right? So I can write down the, in particular, the exponential is a nice function that I can write it down as a convergent series, right? So it's an infinite infinite polynomial, sum over phi to the n over with whatever coefficient over n factorial, depending whether you want.
Sometimes it gets interested sick. Right. That's correct. So you might have to worry. But as long as if you take if you wish pretty much any regular function and
so it's a very good point. So we actually have to expand this a little bit further. So so it's an arbitrary real function. Well, I will put real analytic function in the vicinity of phi. Okay. In the vicinity of phi, which will be our ground state if it exists. So, but that's too much of the fine print already. So in particular, exponential will work because, so f of phi is, well, if it is e to the phi, right, so this is some phi to the n over n factorial. So it's an infinite polynomial. And actually, in general, when I mean, you know, I will allow myself to be loose and take into account infinite polynomial. In fact, it is possible. Okay, so since you asked this question, so it could be that I can take as f of phi, and in some models it indeed happens, which is something like 1 over phi. Okay? From the perspective of a superfield, it's also well-defined. Right? In order for me to construct a well-defined quantum field theory, or something more general, as long as there will be a particular expectation value, right? And then if I can do around that point sort of a Taylor series expansion with a finite radius of convergence, then I can use any function there. The question is whether I will have that point or not to do the expansion above. And that will be the question whether or not I have a ground state in the system. So sometimes you can have a supersymmetric quantum field series which give rise to runaway potentials. So you don't have that point. But if it so happens that the ground state will pick up a particular point in a configuration space around which that function is analytic, then my argument will work. Because I can do a Taylor series expansion and there will be a finite radius of convergence there. So it's a generalization to an infinite polynomial. All right, so that's all very good questions. So let's move on. And so what we need to do is is to evaluate each part there. Well, so let's see. So d phi, right? So d phi is del over del theta minus I theta star del over del t. And I have to act with this differential operator on my superfield. So it's phi plus theta psi minus theta star psi star. And then I have plus theta, theta star f. Okay, so each component in the superfield depends on time, and I will not be writing that time dependent. Okay, so let's see what will survive once I take this derivative. So I have a Grassmann derivative. This will give me zero. This will pick up psi, right? So I will have psi of t when this guy acts on here. On the next one, it will produce zero. And then I will have remaining one, theta star times f. Okay. Now I need to act with this operator, right? And so this one will act, when acted on this, will give me this little phi dot. Okay. Now, this operator cannot act on it can act on psi, right? So I will have plus I theta star psi dot, right? So I always write it down in a way that will be easy to read off the components of the superfield, right? So when I acted with a minus, I flipped theta and theta star, so there is a plus sign there. And that's it, right? So this guy, once I multiply on this or on this, it will vanish because theta star squared equal to zero. So what do we have? So we have that it's the psi of t plus theta star. Here I have f of t minus I phi dot as a function of t plus I theta star psi star. Psi dot, sorry. We can do exactly the same exercise with d star phi. It's a very straightforward. And once we do that, then we will get psi star of t. Then there will be minus theta f plus I phi dot. And then there will be plus I theta star psi dot. So very good. Now, so what we have, we will need to evaluate the product of these two superfields, d phi, d dagger phi. So let's do that computation. So what I need to do, I need to multiply this object by this object and expand it as a superfield. Actually, I don't need to do all the algebra, because ultimately, the only thing that will survive is the theta star term. So d phi, d vega phi. And so I'm just gonna keep this theta-theta star term. I will not write anything else. So anything else I will write down with dots. So they will not be the highest component in these products. And so once I integrate over the whole superspace, they will vanish. Okay, so how can we get highest components? Well, so we need to multiply those two things, right? So what we can do, we can multiply this bracket by this bracket. So it's, you pretty much look through whatever terms will get collected into theta theta star, and what you will find out is this: f squared plus phi dot squared. Right, so this one is coming, once I multiply this by this, and I flip a minus sign, right, because I need to change the order, I wrote it as theta theta star. And then there will be two more terms, phi psi psi dot star minus I psi dot psi star. Okay, so this is a very straightforward algebra to do this. Okay, good. So so now the integral of d theta star of theta theta star. So last time we discussed that Grassmann integration is the same as differentiation. So I have d over d theta star, theta theta star. So it's minus d theta star over d theta star equals to minus 1. So what this tells me that the integral of d theta star of minus 1/2 d phi d dagger phi gives me what? So it will be minus 1/2 of that bracket there. Minus 1/2 f squared plus phi dot squared plus I psi psi dot star psi psi star psi psi dagger. Sorry? Thank you. Yes. Great. So we did one part of the Grassmann integral, and then we are left with this term. So let's see what will happen there. So what we need again, we need to figure out what is a theta theta component. Sorry, theta theta star component of f of phi. So how do we evaluate that? Well, we write down f. It's a function of superfield components, right? And so this is theta psi psi star, and then I have plus theta theta star f. Okay. Now the way how I can think of this is that So this is just a bosonic field. And so the way I'm gonna think of this, as phi plus delta phi, right? So I'm gonna call all this delta phi. And I'm gonna do a Taylor series expansion in this delta phi. So in general, there would have been an infinitely many terms. So in general, I would have n equals 0 to infinity, the nth derivative evaluated at phi times delta phi to the n over n factorial. However, notice that the way how I define my delta phi, it contains Grassmann coordinates. So I cannot have more, so delta phi cube is identically equal to 0. okay, delta phi q force, and so forth. Any higher powers of delta phi will be zero, right? Because if I take cube, well, you can see that there will be repeating Grassmann variables, and a square of the same Grassmann variable is zero. So what this tells us is that in this infinite Taylor series expansion, there will be only three first terms. So there will be f of phi, right? And then there will be another term, which is f prime of phi, right, times delta phi. And then there will be f double prime of phi over 2 delta phi squared. All right. So any questions? Is it clear?
So now, notice that what we are after.
We are after theta star component. So all I need to do is to extract theta star term from this Taylor series expansion. So the first term does not have, this is just a bosonic component. So I don't have anything. So it's equal. Then I have f prime of phi, right? And so I need to extract the theta star term from delta phi, right? Plus I have f w prime of phi, and I have delta phi squared over 2, and I need to extract theta star term from their product of 2 delta phis. Okay? Good. So this equals f prime, right? Now, the theta star term is just the highest component, so it gives me f. And then I have plus f w prime of phi over 2. And then I have to take delta phi, and I need to multiply it. And so what I will get this, theta star, psi star, minus theta star, psi star, theta psi. Okay, and then there will, yeah, so this is just a, well, I might as well keep here theta star. So I'm going to write this down as theta star. And then what I have left here is f prime times capital F. And then the combination there will take a very nice form, f w prime over 2. And then here we have a commutator, psi and psi star. So that already starts resembling our supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Okay, so there is no mystery here, right? So it's just a simple simple integration of Grassmann variables. Okay, and so the last step, we just have to combine wherever we got there with that additional term. Again, the theta star integration gives me minus 1. And so the answer is, once we combine everything, we will get a Lagrangian, which is guaranteed to lead to a supersymmetric actions, right? The variation of that Lagrangian is going to be a total derivative. And so our Suzy action is going to be an integral over dt So I have 1/2 f squared plus 1/2 phi dot squared, and then I have plus 1/2 I psi psi dot minus I psi dot psi star, right? So I just copied the four terms there, divided by 2. And then I have to subtract what we found there, f prime f minus f double prime over 2 psi psi star commutator.
If I uncommute this, it will be plus, and then I have psi psi star, which is the same as this. Alright, so very good.
So it doesn't look immediately like our supersymmetric quantum mechanics, but let's see what we can do here. So in the supersymmetric, let me write down what we have in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, what we did before. Remember we started from supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We introduced Heisenberg operators, and we wrote an effective action which produces the Hamiltonian of a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so this was the action of the 0 plus 1 dimensional supersymmetric quantum mechanics, supersymmetric quantum field theory, I should say now. And it was of this form, so it's dt, and then 1/2 phi dot squared plus I psi star psi dot, and then I have minus 1/2 f prime squared plus 1/2 f double prime over 2. Okay, so this is what we had before, and this is what we have now. Okay. So let's just carefully compare those two terms. So I'm going to cross out the terms which are the same. Okay, on both sides. Well, this guy, okay, there is no 1/2 here. So this term is exactly the same as this one. It's just the order in the commutator different. So those two terms are the same. Right, so I have the same kinetic term for a bosonic scalar, a real bosonic scalar. Now, this guy here, I can anti-commute those two Grassmann fields, psi dot and psi star, and I will get a plus sign. So I can have from here plus I over 2 psi star psi dot, which will be half of the contribution here. But then what I can do, I can integrate this term by parts. Once I integrate this term by parts, I will get minus I over 2 psi dot psi star. Okay. So to go from here to here, I integrate by parts. But then this term here is plus I over 2 psi star psi dot. So which gives me the other half of the contribution. And so this term here is precisely the same as the two terms there. So the only difference that we see for now is this guy, the potential. That's what we have in our 0 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory. And the supersymmetric action, S SUSY, delta S SUSY, equals integral over del t. And what do we have here? 1/2 f squared minus f prime f. Okay, so this is a part that slightly disagrees at first glance. But in fact, it does not. So the reason is that, notice, there is something very special about this field F, right? So field F, it's a field, but this is a field that does not have a kinetic term. So this is a field that enters quadratically. So what I can do, so what we can do is, and this is our first encounter with the idea of integrating out. So we can integrate out. We can integrate out F exactly. Okay, I want to emphasize that this process is an exact process. So what exactly do I mean by that? And this is an important concept, and it extends to four dimensions and more. So there will be, when we formulate our quantum field series, we formulate our quantum field series as path integrals. So I'm going to look at the part of the path integral. So let's look at the part of a path integral. That involves F integration, okay? And so F enters quadratically. Into Lagrangian. Okay, so we have a path integral. We have to integrate over all possible fields df. And the relevant part for this integral is e to the is, I delta s. So it's a functional integral of this type, e to the I integral over dt, and then I have 1/2 f squared minus f little f prime. Okay? So this guy depends on t. This guy depends on T, and this depends on the bosonic field phi. So what I can do, I can complete the square here. So it will be integral over df, right? So then it's I integral dt, 1/2 f minus f prime squared. And so you can see that I have I integral over dt left with minus f prime squared over 2. Right? Now, this part does not depend on capital F, the field that we integrate over. So as far as this functional integral concerned, this exponential is just a constant. So I can write this down as e to the I integral over dt of minus f prime squared over 2. And then I'm left with this functional integral. I can introduce a new variable, f hat. So f hat I define by shifting my old f by f prime. So as far as f integral is concerned, for any fixed value of little phi, right, that's a constant shift. And then my integral becomes just this. Okay? So notice that this integral does not depend on any other field. And it's an integral over any field configuration. So this is just a constant. This is just a constant that can be absorbed into overall normalization of the path integral. So what this tells me that I still haven't, I just explained you on the level of a path integral what we did. But then I will go back and I will explain these words. Integrate out f exactly. What I argued for you that I can exactly compute the f integral, right? That's what I did. And so this is just a constant times e to the I integral over dt minus f prime squared over 2. So, but this way tells me that after, if I combine this with parts of the action over which I did not compute the functional integral yet, so that what we have so let me show what we have in general. So we have a general path integral. So the path integral was with respect to little field phi, psi star. And it was an integral, the functional integral with respect to this field capital F, right? And then here, here what we had e to the is Susi, right? And so so what I just argued that I can compute this integral exactly. So I'm still left with these integrals. Okay. And then the action is just some constant. The constant is just the integral. So this constant is a functional integral of this type, df hat of e to the I integral over dt f hat squared. Okay. And then the actions that I have is precisely the action I S 0 plus 1 supersymmetric quantum field theory. Okay? Because once I perform that integral, then the non-trivial piece that is left is minus F prime squared over 2, which is exactly the piece that we needed to reproduce here.
So is that clear?
Did I convince you that this is an exact procedure of evaluating the path integral? Yes.
So, are you pushing on the exact procedure?
Or? Yes, that's what I wanted to say precisely what the integrate out means. So the reason why I went through these steps, because I wanted to show that if my field enters quadratically, then that's an exact procedure. So it is not exact to do what you are suggesting to do right now. So this is an exact, this is the way how you always have to think. Unfortunately, you cannot do that except in the situation when you have, when you're basically completing a square in order to evaluate the functional integral. But with you are suggesting right now is that sort of use a saddle point approximation, okay? Using a saddle point approximation in evaluating a functional integral is to look at the equation of motion. And this is known as a procedure of integrating off. So there is a shorter route to that. And this is integrating out field F. Okay. So the steps. So you can always do that, but you have to understand that that is not an exact procedure. That is true. So only exact if F is non-dynamical and enters into Lagrangian quadratic.
So that will be an exact procedure. That's one time when it's exact. Second time when it's exact, if F is infinitely massive. If it is a massive field in the approximation, when we can think of that the mass of this field is very large, then we can again use this procedure of integrating out. But the arrows that we will be making is at the roughly the mass scale of this field. That will come back and haunt us when we will be doing a lot of this procedure later at a less precise level. So how do we do the integrating out? So step number one, we just look at the equations, solve equations, solve equation of motion for capital F, right? So when we write down the equation of motion, we have F minus F prime equal to zero. Now that's the same as doing, this is the same as doing saddle point approximation. In pass integral. Okay? So once you solve the equation of motion, you find out that capital F equals to F prime on the equation of motion, and then substitute back. Which is evaluate the integral at its saddle point. Okay? So once we substitute back, then 1f f squared minus f prime f equals minus 1/2 f prime squared, which is exactly what we need in order to match those two actions. So now we showed that those two actions are identical. So the reason why this acts here precisely is because this first step, saddle point approximation, for a Gaussian integral is an exact statement. There is nothing more than just doing a saddle point in a Gaussian integral. That's why it led to correct answer exactly. And that's the reason I went through this a little bit painful thing through the pass integral. Yeah?
That should be
saddle point approximation.
The only way we can compute anything in quantum field theory is any functional integral is a Gaussian integral, right? So suppose I have an integral dx e to the f of x. How do I evaluate this integral? If I give you a complicated function, you will not know how to do it. But the idea is the following. So suppose my function, suppose that my function is positive, I have minus f of x, and so the function has a bunch of minimum, okay? So what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna approximate this function f of x. I'm gonna approximate this function by a set of saddle points. So I'm finding a point, I'm asking when this integral will dominate. This integral will dominate when this function is minimum. Okay, so it's minimum at x1 and x2. And so I ask, what is the contribution to this integral around x1? Well, around x1, I have f of x1, and then I have so the function is curved upwards because it's minimum, so it's lambda x minus x1 squared, okay? And so if I, so the first step I am making, I'm making an approximation by saying the dominant contribution to this integral will come from these two points, from the minima of the function, and near each of the minimum, the function will have this form. So what I'm saying that this integral is approximately integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dx, e to the minus f of x1 minus lambda 1, x minus x1, right, squared, and then plus the same around the second point, if you have second saddle point, Okay. Now the integral, and so of course there will be contributions to the integral coming from in between, but I can neglect it if those are really truly minimal. Okay. Well, whether or not saddle point works, and whenever it works, it depends on the specific problem. But notice that once you do this, then this is e to the minus f of x1, and then I can do change of variable there, and so it will be over root lambda 1, and this will be something like dy minus y squared integral, and the same from the other one. So that gives you, this is what is known as a saddle plus from the other saddle, f of x2 over root lambda 2 times the same integral, dy e to the minus y squared. So this method of evaluating the integral is a saddle point approximation. Yes?
What can you do if there's a I from the f? And then
you can do that, and then it will be a statement about highly oscillating integrals, right? And then you would be saying the words. So here I am saying the words that my integral is much, much less other than at those two points. Now, what you would be saying is that you are integrating a highly oscillating function, and so the contribution is zero. So the difference is, I would still call it a saddle point approximation, and the difference in the context of quantum field theory is whether you are doing saddle point approximation once you do Euclidean quantum field theory. So what I'm discussing there is more like a Euclidean quantum field theory. And if you have an I, then you would be saying exactly the same words, moduli, you would be saying highly oscillating contributions, but you will be talking about Minkowski quantum field theory.
Wouldn't there be any difference? Because if you just do the particle over the I, then you have also contribution from the maximum. Because you only, that's, I think that's where a saddle point comes originally from, because it just
is. Right. So
the Euclidean nice integral, you only have the minimum.
Yes. So you will be picking up all the extreme. So notice that philosophically, it's not very dissimilar once we were doing perturbative supersymmetry. Right. So what we were doing, we were finding a minimum of the function and replacing that with a, with a quadratic potential. So in some sense, the saddle point approximation is exactly the perturbative supersymmetry.
Stationary phase.
Yeah, that's very good sense. Yeah. So there, if you do it in a complex, then that's a stationary phase approximation. Stationary phase is because the phase around here doesn't change much. The function doesn't change much. The function only changes at the quadratic level as you move away from that point. So in fact, if you think what we did, we precisely did the saddle point approximation. And there, if you ask yourself, if I do in general, integrating out in quantum field theory, and we'll be coming back to that again. And by integrating out, we will be making, those are the two steps we are gonna make. We look at some field, we solve what is the equation of motion for that field and substitute it back. And then we will get the action which involves less number of fields, okay? And so that is a procedure of integrating out. But you have to understand when this procedure works. It works, so the second place when it works is that this saddle point approximation when the field is infinitely massive. So if the field is very massive, then that minimum is really, really steep. The curvature is huge. So which means that if you move a little bit away from that point, the contribution of the function away from the just from the minimum will be infinitely suppressed. Okay, that's why it means that the saddle point approximation will be better and better if the field is massive. But now you can actually foresee some things that we will discuss later in the class. Notice that this field, it depends on the other fields when we integrate off, right? It depends on the shift that we are making. And it's clear that in more complicated examples, what happens is that not only the expectation value of the field, but the mass of this field will depend on what other fields are doing as well. Okay? So what you did, you integrated out the field. You assumed that it's infinitely massive, and you have a set of fields, right? So a set of fields meaning that you went from a pass integral.
Did I erase that one?
Yeah, I erased that one. So you went to a pass integral involving one less integration. And so you already lost the information. How does the mass of this field depend on whatever the fields you left? And so what could happen, and we will see an explicit example of that, is that as we go in a configuration space of the leftover quantum field theory, this capital F field will be massless, can become massless at very particular points in the configuration space. And then this approximation breaks down completely. That's the worst possible case. If that field becomes massless, the approximation breaks down. And what it shows, what it will show up in our discussion, it will show up as our effective field theory. So what we did, we started with a field theory that had more fields, and then we obtained an effective description. We obtained a quantum field theory involving less number of fields. And so what will happen if we make if the quantum field theory is interesting enough, then you will discover that this effective quantum field theory breaks down. And it will precisely break down at the point when this capital F field that you try to integrate out will become massless. Okay? So in our case, that's not a problem. Because in our case, the mass, which is this one half coefficient, is always constant. By the way, what's funny about this capital F field? What's funny about its mass? Well, if I forget about this F prime F, then it's a tachyon, right? It has a negative mass squared. But that's okay. As long as it enters quadratically, I can still evaluate the path integral. So this is like somebody was saying that we can do a stationary point when we do a Minkowski one. Then we will be picking not only the minima, but we will be picking up the maxima as well.
If we have a mass, it doesn't have
a station, so it becomes interpolated. Right. So by mass, I mean that you're absolutely right. It's a nonsensical question because I don't have a kinetic term. And I need to have a kinetic term so that I have a canonically normalized field to say what the mass is. And here I don't have it. So I'm being a little bit naive and saying, let me look at non-derivative part of the action, and I call the non-derivative part minus the potential. If I say that, then that field has a mass minus 1/2. That's all what I meant. All right, guys, so let's finish this, and starting a couple more things. And next lecture, we will go back to four dimensions, and we will never leave four dimensions until the end of the course. So the last thing I want to mention on the supersymmetric quantum mechanics is another important notion. Okay. So we made a superfield formalism, right? And superfield combined different components, right? Different fields. So it provides a representation. So if I am to write a slogan, the slogan is that a superfield provides a representation of Susi algebra. So it includes the components which under supersymmetry transformations get mixed with themselves.
However, the important point is that in general, this representation is reducible. Okay? So we will see this. The example that I want to mention is a little bit artificial in the context of quantum mechanics, but in the context of quantum field theory, once we will construct the most general superfield, sort of as a Taylor expansion in these Grassmann coordinates, what we will get will be a reducible representation, meaning that under the supersymmetry transformation, there will be subsets of the components that do not mix with each other. And so one example of that is a chiral superfield. So I'm going to explain you the notion of a chiral superfield in this context of quantum mechanics, which provide, if you wish, an irreducible representation of a supersymmetry algebra, and it will have less number of components. So let me go into chiral superfields. So it's a little, as I said, it's a little bit artificial construction. So a chiral superfield, so a definition, X is a chiral superfield. So this is a notation that I'm going to use. This means chiral superfield. So X is a chiral superfield if D dagger acted on X is identically zero. So if I take this covariant derivative D dagger, act on X, and I will get identically zero. So can I write down the most general chiral superfield? And the answer to this question is yes. It's very easy. Well, so recall that D dagger is del over del theta star minus I theta del over del T. So what I can observe that there are two coordinates. There are chiral coordinates. And those chiral coordinates are theta, right? That's one of them. And the other one is tau t, which is t minus I theta star. Why do I call those coordinates chiral? It's because if I take this covariant derivative, d dagger, and I act on my chiral coordinates, I will get automatically zero. Okay? So those are two chiral coordinates, and you can verify that indeed they are annihilated by d dagger. So what this tells us that I can very easily construct a chiral superfield. All I have to do is just to take an arbitrary function that depends on chiral coordinates, okay? A chiral superfield is an arbitrary function of chiral coordinates. So in other words, X is a function of theta and tau, right? It's clear why this is chiral, right? The reason why this is chiral is because D dagger, if I act on theta and tau, I can think of this as dx acted on alpha as a function of alpha and beta, and then d dagger on alpha plus dx over d beta, if I think use a chain rule of differentiation, right? And then it will automatically vanish. Okay, so that's a chiral superfield. Note that this is not a most general superfield, okay? Not the most general. The reason why it's not the most general, well, the most general one, as you remember, depended on three coordinates. And now it depends, it's a function of only two coordinates. That's why it's not a surprise when they tell you that it provides a reducible, that chiral superfield will provide reducible representation, and this one is in general irreducible. So now I can use, just to justify it again, so I can do a Taylor series expansion, and remember that a Taylor series expansion for a general superfield was a little bit long, and for the chiral superfield, it's actually much simpler. So a chiral superfield, if I do a Taylor series expansion in this theta variable, so I can have phi as a function of tau, or theta as a function of psi, that's it. As a function of tau. It cannot depend on, there are just two components, phi and psi. There is no f, there is no highest component here. Of course, this is a superfield, and I can further expand it, so I can recall that tau equals t minus I theta, theta star, and I can Taylor series expand in these Grassmann coordinates, and once I do this, then I will get phi of t plus theta psi of t minus I theta, theta star, phi dot of t. So if you wish, a chiral superfield is a special type of a more general superfield in which psi is real, right? That's one thing. Psi star is absent, and the highest component is just I phi dot. Okay? Now, how can we make, well, how do we construct supersymmetric actions involving chiral superfield? Before I do that, I'm just gonna point one quick thing. I really want, guys, let's, I have 2 minutes, but I will probably take 5 minutes altogether, then we will end quantum mechanics today, and I don't wanna come back to that again. So, so the thing is that if I take an arbitrary superfield phi, okay, so we can construct a chiral, so we can get chiral superfield by simply acting with d dagger on phi. So d dagger of phi is automatically chiral. The reason is very simple, because d dagger of phi is the same as d dagger squared acted on phi, zero acted on phi equals to zero. Okay, so if I take any superfield and act on it with d dagger, I will get automatically chiral superfield. Now, let me show you how I can construct the supersymmetric actions or pieces of the action. Well, as a chiral, supersymmetric chiral pieces of the action, I can just integrate with respect to half of the superspace. By half of the superspace mean that I integrate only, I take the whole space-time coordinates, in this case it's time, but I take only half of the Grassmann coordinates, one half of all Grassmann coordinates. Okay? One half of all Grassmann coordinates. And then the statement is that if I take a chiral superfield, and you can convince yourself that a product of two chiral superfields is a chiral superfield and so on, so a chiral superfield form a closed subalgebra, and the statement is that this action, if you take a chiral superfield and integrate with respect to half the superspace now, it will have its supersymmetry variation being a total derivative. So delta SUSY of S chiral equals integral over dt total derivative. I'm just gonna show you that that's indeed the case. And that's where we will end. So it's simple. So well, we know that this is where L is a superfield, right? This is Susi invariant, right? But then the derivative over theta star is the same as differential with respect to theta star. So what I can do, I can take this, what I had before, and add to it a total derivative. Well, actually, I'm going to write this down as d dagger plus I theta del over del t. So if you use a definition of what d dagger is, then the combination here is precisely del over del theta star. Again, acted on arbitrary superfield. So I haven't done anything. I just rewrote the supersymmetric action in terms in this way. But notice that this is a total derivative. So wherever I have it, it will give rise to a total derivative. And so this will not contribute to any equation of motion. So what we have that the supersymmetric action can be written in this way, d dagger of L. But I just proved you seconds ago that when you give me an arbitrary superfield and you act with it on it with d dagger, you will get a chiral superfield. So that tells you that this is the variation of that thing will give rise to a total derivative. All right, guys, so we're done with supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and we'll start the real stuff next time.